Well, I want to thank all of you, first off, for your help in making the Skeptics Forums last Sunday morning and Monday evening such a success. And we did video record the Monday night event, and we tested the live streaming. The live streaming works, so next time we'll be live stream literally throughout the world. In fact, we're going to actually test. We did this last Monday night. Tested whether or not we could take questions from the online audience, and that worked pretty well. So we know next time that's going to be okay. Also, I think it's going to make it easier for you to promote the events, because we intend to give you little video clips of the Monday night event that you can share with people. So thank you for making it happen, and thank you too for all of you who participated in getting posters out and alerting newspapers of the event, because as you can see, most of the people that did come were people who had never been to one before. So let's see if we can wrap up our segment on the anthropic principle and equality. Those of you who are new to the class, we're studying human origins, in particular looking at Psalm 51 and Psalm 139 as it speaks to the origin of humanity. And this is a subject matter that's receiving tremendous challenge in the church today, particularly with those who hold to a theistic evolutionary perspective, who are literally challenging the idea that the human species is descended just from two people, a single man and a single woman, that lived a few tens of thousands of years ago, what we now know to be the Middle East area. And so we'll be getting into some of the DNA studies that are central to this debate. In fact, I'll be giving you an update on a debate that Fuzz Ronnie, actually had two debates, Fuzz with Dennis Benema, one of the leaders of the theistic evolutionary movement. And of course, this also is a response to an atheistic perspective on human origins. But I think this subject that we're dealing with, the anthropic principle and equality, is really central, a good preface to the whole DNA debate. And if you haven't been with us, one component of that is that given the laws of physics that we see structuring the universe, it requires a minimum of a little less than 14 billion years to provide all the resources that human beings and human civilization needs. And this is because given the physics of the universe, it takes several generations of stars being born and scattering their ashes into outer space before you have the right mix of elements that would even make possible a planet like Earth. And in fact, there's a moment when the universe is about 9.2 billion years old where you have a maximum abundance of the long-lived radiometric elements. And those long-lived radiometric elements are key to driving plate tectonics and setting up, which allows continents to form, and setting up a strong, stable magnetic field that protects our atmosphere from being sputtered away by solar radiation, and at the same time protects us from cosmic radiation. Thanks to that strong magnetic field, we have Van Allen belts which shield us from that deadly radiation. But the whole point is, okay, 9.2 billion years, why doesn't God just bring human beings here 4.5 billion years ago? Well, there's several reasons why you need that extra 4.5 billion years. Let me just quickly review this. We've covered this before. When you look at the sun, you notice that it has high flaring activity when it's young and high flaring activity when it's old. It has maximum or minimum flaring activity when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. So you want to add that 4.57 to the 9.2, which really helps us understand why we must be living in a universe that's 13.75 billion years old. And as we look at that stability point, we appreciate a number of facts, namely that stars that are more massive than the sun or less massive than the sun have greater flaring activity. So if you want that minimum flaring activity, which human civilization needs, your planet must orbit a star that's exactly the mass of the sun. And as I pointed out, that minimum flaring happens when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. And neutrino studies tell us that the sun is only able to sustain maximum solar luminosity stability for about 100,000 years. And we entered that maximum luminosity stability phase 50,000 years ago, which means at best we got 50,000 more years to go before we exit that period of extreme solar luminosity stability. And we've also covered this, how when you look at the continents, it takes the decay of long-lived radiometric elements operating for several billion years in order to transform the basalts that form the ocean floors into silicates, and silicates being, by the way, silicate is essentially hydrated basalt. So water reacts chemically with the basalts, makes silicates. The silicates are lighter, and if that goes on for sufficient time, eventually enough silicate floats above the basalts that you get continents. And this curve shows you the continental land growth. And incidentally, that's consistent with Genesis 1, which tells us that the period of the most aggressive continental landmass development took place at the beginning of creation day 3. And the continents continue to grow and continue to move as a result of plate tectonics. And one of the things we notice is that we are living now at the optimal time in terms of the size of the continents and the orientation and structure of the continents. There was a time when North America was separate from South America and are now joined together. And being joined together, you see that there's a strong north-south barrier to the flow of the oceans. And that strong north-south barrier enables the oceans to have the best possible circulation so that you, and that's basically what sustains the climates over the world, is where the ocean currents are flowing. And so, for example, we live in a region where we have the Japanese current, which basically keeps California cool and keeps Alaska and British Columbia warm. Because we get the deep flow part of the current in Southern California, and you get the warm part in British Columbia and Alaska, which means we can actually have people living and developing civilization all along North America, north all the way up to south, up to south all the way up to north. In fact, I can tell you this, when I arrived here in Southern California in 1973, I was quite stunned by how cold the ocean water was. I was expecting the ocean water here to be warmer than it is in British Columbia. It's actually the other way around. Ocean water is warmer in British Columbia than it is here in California. So I had to get used to that. But what that means is that we can enjoy going to the beach in California and in British Columbia. In fact, when we did our cruise up to Alaska this summer, our Reasons to Believe cruise, quite a few of the people on our cruise went snorkeling off of Ketchikan. And I can tell you the water off of Ketchikan in summer is warmer than the water off of California in the summer. So people enjoyed it. And you didn't even need to have a wetsuit up there. But that's all thanks to the way the continents are shaped, the sizes of the continents, and the orientation. And it's not just North and South America. We notice that also Asia, Europe, and Africa are oriented in such a way as to make sure that we've got ocean currents that create a benign climate over the maximum surface area of the Earth. And want to note, too, that the separation of the continents is crucial. Notice that you've got 30 big oceans between North America and South America and Europe and Africa. And if you look at a globe, you will see, especially if you look at the continental shelves, that the continental shelf off of Africa perfectly fits the continental shelf off the east coast of South America, which is one piece of evidence that we have that the continents were once joined all together. In fact, if you look in the Brazil area and West Africa, you'll see the same fossils existing in South America as you will in Africa, dating to the same time, indicating again that the life that was predominant in Brazil a quarter of a billion years ago was the same life that was predominant in West Africa. We also see magnetic striping in the rocks that tells us they're at one time one continent. Now, the problem with having all the continents joined together and being one is that means that you're going to have significant portions of the land masses that are far away from the oceans. And they're far away from the oceans, they're not going to get much rainfall. And so by having the continents separate with large oceans between them, where none of the continents are that large, that means you're going to minimize the desert regions. Now you might say, well, Africa is a big continent, and it's got a big desert in it. Yes, it does. You've got the Sahara Desert there. But I want to remind you, it's human activity that's made the Sahara Desert 10 times bigger than what it was in the days of the Roman Empire. So there was a time when what we now call the Sahara Desert was much smaller. In fact, if you go back to the time of the Roman Empire, what we now call the Sahara Desert was actually the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. That was a granary for the Roman Empire. Now they can't grow grain there at all. Likewise, if you look at Asia, yes, it's a big continent like Africa. And if you look in Central Asia, there's a desert there, the Gobi Desert. But again, human activity has made the Gobi Desert four times bigger than it was in the days of, say, the Roman Empire. In fact, the Gobi Desert is growing at quite a rapid rate today and has now reached the suburbs of Beijing. Where when I was a young boy, it was several hundred miles away from Beijing. It's now actually encroached right into the city. Yes?
If the deserts got bigger because of human activity, if there was commitment to making them smaller again, is that possible now?
Yes. Yes, very much. I mean, how these deserts have gotten to be so big so fast is that people living around the edge of the deserts have basically been stripping the land of vegetation predominantly for cooking fuel or for keeping their huts warm if you go to, say, Mongolia. Sahara is warm enough where you don't need it so much for heat, but they need it for cooking fuel. And in the Gobi Desert, they need it both for heat and cooking fuel. And so they literally strip everything, not just the trees, but the shrubs, the grasses, everything, use it for fuel. And basically, when you take the vegetation off, there's not enough respiration from the plants. Because, you know, when plants are thriving, they're expelling water vapor to the atmosphere. But when you take the plants off, that's gone. The rainfall drops, which makes it more difficult for the plants to grow, which makes for bigger deserts. It becomes a runaway problem. In fact, if you go back 20, 30 years, the Sahara Desert was advancing southward by 6 miles a year. So, I mean, it can be quite rapid. I mean, just 100 years, you've got a 600-mile advance southward of the desert. Now, it can be reversed. Basically, what you do is you train the people that are around the desert to stop using the vegetation of the desert for fuel. But that's probably not going to happen unless we go to the sub-Saharan peoples. Actually, I recommend this in my Job book, saying, you know, one of the ways we can help global warming is go to the sub-Saharan peoples and say, we'll give you all the petroleum you want for free. Use as much of it as you want. We won't charge you. We'll provide it for you for free on one condition. You work with us to replant the Sahara Desert. And one, you know, testimony of that is what the Jewish people did when they took control of the Judean highlands. Within 15 years, they doubled the rainfall on the Judean highlands simply by planting trees and planting grasses in a step-by-step fashion. And, you know, within 15 years, the rainfall had doubled. And now there's forests over what used to be barren rock in the Judean highlands. So if we simply take that Jewish model and apply it to the Gobi Desert and the Sahara Desert, that could be replanted in fairly short order. And that would soak up lots of greenhouse gases, which would be good for the environment, not to mention the fact that now you've got crops that can come from that region, where today nothing comes from that region. So it would actually stimulate the economy of that region. I give that as one example in the Job book, that if you actually follow the advice of Job 37 and 38, then when you face environmental crises, there is a solution that God has pre-designed into our environment that is simultaneously optimally ethical and optimally economic. And, you know, it's always going to be difficult to persuade people to sacrifice their economy to do the right thing, or to do the reverse. In order to have an economic payoff, to do the non-ethical thing. But the good news is God has already designed the earth and its resources and its life in such a way that there's always a solution. where you can combine maximal ethics with maximal economic return, which means that you don't have to worry about the politics. The liberals will vote for it, the conservatives will vote for it. So keep it out of the political realm. You were first.
I'm wondering about the connection between the North American and the South American continents. It's very narrow. It's enough to control the ocean flow.
Right.
But it must be, I mean, if the air goes over there better without changing over the continent, is it there for a purpose?
Well, supposing North and South America weren't connected, then you'd have ocean currents cutting through, and that would disturb the ocean current flows, especially in the Pacific. And so the fact that they are joined at Panama makes sure that the Atlantic oceanic currents flow in the north-south direction, and at the same time that the Pacific ocean currents flow in the north-south direction. Otherwise, it'd be east-west. Right. And if it's east-west, you wind up having less rainfall falling over the continents, and you wind up having greater temperature extremes.
So, God make it so narrow right there in order to allow the air?
Well, kind of what I'm suggesting is this, that God chose the ideal time in the tectonic history of the earth to put human beings on the face of the earth. Because what did he say to Adam and Eve? Multiply and fill the earth. And I'm giving you a command to manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit of all life. Now, for that to work, we human beings have to occupy all the land masses. If we don't, we're not going to be able to take an inventory of Earth's resources, let alone manage it wisely for the benefit of all life, which means that the continents must be shaped and sized and oriented in such a way that it actually becomes possible for human beings in a relatively short period of time to multiply, fill, and occupy the Earth. And so if you actually look at a globe, what you notice is that the continents are shaped and sized in such a way that people, because after all, the Bible tells us that the entire human species comes from one man and one woman living in one place. They have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but now you've got to get them to all the places of the Earth. Well, at the time of Adam and Eve, North America was joined to Siberia. So there was a 500-mile-wide land bridge, and there was a 3,000-year-wide window of time when the temperature at the bridge joining Siberia to Alaska was an average temperature of 56 degrees Fahrenheit, which means it was possible. That's much warmer than what it is now, which means that people migrating out of the Middle East into Siberia had a sufficiently warm temperature, which means they also had a food supply that would facilitate their migration. And they've actually discovered in the Bering Strait region that there were grains there that were being harvested by these early humans. So actually they had a grain supply, wild grains that they could harvest as they were walking from Siberia into Alaska. And likewise, there was a bridge joining Britain to France, because we now have evidence that humans were in Britain very early, and that was possible because there was a land bridge joining them. And likewise, there wasn't a solid land bridge from Asia all the way to Australia, but the straits were much narrower than they are today, which means that people could sit on Asia and look over to an island and say, we can get there, because after all, the water is warm, and it's not like the Bering Strait, where the water is treacherous, because there wasn't a strong current flowing through there. So they could literally hop island to island and get to Australia. And so humans were able to settle into Australia about 40,000 years ago. But as the ice age began to subside, that melting snow and ice began to cause the sea levels to go up. Moreover, the lack of ice on Siberia and Canada caused both North America and Asia to rebound. And so with the weight of ice no longer there, they basically rebounded and floated up, which means that you got the continents going up. At the same time, you got the ocean waters going up, which causes the continents to have significant separation. Now, what's really going on here? What do you see in Genesis chapter 11? God notices that human beings are refusing to obey His command to multiply and fill the earth. They're basically, you know, thumbing their nose at God and saying, we're going to live in one place, with one city, with one government, and we're not going to be scattered over the face of the earth. And God recognized that that was a prescription for the repeat of the evil that existed in the days before the flood. Fairly obvious. If all you got is one government, one nation, what are the leaders of that nation going to do? They're going to raise the taxes and lower the services, right? They will oppress the citizens. So that's not a good situation. So what God wanted was multiple nations where there's free market competition for both the citizens as well as the economic endeavor of those citizens. And so that meant, you know, getting people out of that one place where they got you know, multiple governments, multiple nations. But notice that God's goal was to keep the human population as a system of multiple nations. And for that reason, He was concerned that if He scattered people over the face of the earth, they would simply come back. So to prevent them from coming back, we have what we see in Genesis 10, verse 25, the world was divided in the days of Peleg. So now that the humans had been scattered into all the places of the world, God moved in such a way to prevent those peoples from coming back by separating the continents from one another. And so there now became water barriers that made it impossible for people living before the Industrial Revolution to migrate from Australia back to Asia. And so the Aborigines in Australia were stuck in Australia. And likewise, the Indians and Eskimos that were in North and South America were stuck in North and South America. They could not go back until modern times. And so what about now? Well, there's actually a prophecy in the book of Revelation that at the time of the end of human civilization, language would cease to be a barrier. I mean, we just heard from Wes here about Bible translations. But literally, a language disappears about once a week. And so there will come a time when language will no longer be a barrier. In fact, I got to see this when I was on the airplane going to Japan. And I was sitting beside a Japanese student who didn't know a word of English. And my Japanese is basically three words. So we were in trouble. But he said, no problem. He pulled out this device, and it was a little computer that was handheld. And he would speak into it, and it would translate. And I mean, it was just incredible. You know, and I'm aware of how difficult it is to go from Japanese to English. And sure, there were some grammatical issues, but we were actually able to communicate on that long flight from Los Angeles to Tokyo, thanks to this little device. And so, but Revelation actually predicts there'll come a time when the borders that God gave us, there's a reference to that in Genesis 11, how God enabled these nations to compete with one another because He gave the nations appropriate geographical borders. Why? Because the mountains, the deserts, and the rivers that might form the border of your nation would be sufficiently difficult to cross that if you were bordering a powerful nation, then that powerful nation would think twice before mounting up an army to get across your geographical borders, which meant that a weaker nation could actually survive right next to a stronger nation. But we're living in a day when borders don't really pose much of a barrier given the technology of modern weaponry. And moreover, race no longer prevents a barrier. Why? Because the different ethnic groups and races of the world are, in these days, intermarrying. In fact, friends of mine that are doing work on the DNA history of humanity complain that within a decade, the human population will be so thoroughly intermarried, just in 10 years, that it's going to make it impossible to do accurate DNA tracing of history of humanity. It's got to be done right now before there's too much of this intermarriage going on. But the bottom line is, I think Revelation's onto something. We're quickly moving into an era when ethnicity will not be a barrier. When this color of our skin will not be a barrier, when our language will not be a barrier, and the geographical borders will not be a barrier. And what does Revelation say? There will be a return to the mistakes that took place in the days before and after the flood, where we'll have one people, one nation, with a government oppressing its citizens for the purpose of propagating evil and not righteousness, basically to wake up humanity to the fact that we can't fix our own problems. We need God to fix our problems. And when we ever try to fix our own problems, we don't do a very good job. We should have learned the lesson, right? We tried to do it ourselves in the days before the flood, look what happened. When we tried to do it for ourselves in the days after the flood, look what happened. And so God had to step in order to make sure that we don't operate in our worst interests. And we've been doing great for thousands of years, but God's going to love. By the way, don't be too concerned. Revelation tells us that God's only going to allow humanity to repeat that experiment of before and after the flood for a very brief period of time. We're talking just a few years, not decades or centuries. And basically, it's a final wake-up call to humanity about our need for God. You've had your hand up the longest of those that are still, so go for it, Al. All right.
Well, first of all, God, Yahweh, chose the Jews, all right? So when he says go and multiply, he meant the Jewish.
No, he meant all of us.
Okay.
Not just
right.
Jews. We're all supposed to multiply and fill the earth, right?
Putting Genesis aside and getting back to science, which you're a scientist, when did the... I've always pondered... I mean, it occurred to me, looking at that goal over there, that when did fish appear? I mean, leaving Genesis aside, when did the fish really appear in the oceans? When were they created? I mean, not Genesis. When were they created?
Well,
scientifically?
Genesis addresses that, and so does science. And they both basically say the same thing.
Right.
With Genesis, it's the beginning of creation day 5. And with science, it's the beginning of the Cambrian explosion. So we're talking 543 million years ago, but you know, the way I read Genesis 1, beginning of creation day 5, let the ocean swarms with these small animals. I believe that's a reference to the Avalon and Cambrian explosion.
Huh? Genesis doesn't have fossils. I mean, what?
No, it does talk about life, though. And it talks about a brand new form of life showing up at the beginning of creation day 5,
when was the Jurassic period?
Jurassic.
The Cambrian period, when was it?
Cambrian begins 543 million years ago. And if you go to the Chinese site for the Cambrian explosion, they actually have vertebrate fish showing up at the very beginning of the Cambrian event. Now, I mean, most of our textbooks say the fish came much later. But what the Chinese fossil site is telling us is that the fish were there right at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion. Now, that leads me to my next slide here, which is we happen to be living at the ideal ocean oxygenation moment. If you look at the history of the Earth, there are times when our oxygen or our oceans are oxygen depleted, what we call hypoxia events, and there are times when the oxygen is at a maximum level. To get the oxygen at the maximum level, you need to be at the right stage in terms of the ice age. You need to have the continents oriented the right way, with the right sizes, with the ocean currents going in the right directions. So if we go back to this slide, the orientation of the continents, the size of the continents, that all plays a role in ensuring that we have maximum oxygen content in the waters of the ocean. And actually, if you look at our oceans, oxygen gets all the way down to about 10,000 feet deep. And so you actually have life in the ocean that's that deep. I mean, that's what sperm whales feed on. The sperm whales will dive down literally thousands of feet, as much as 10,000 feet, to get the giant squid, and the giant squid are feeding on the fish. But that's all possible because there's oxygen down there. You've had your hand up a long time. I'm sorry.
Back to the desert idea. Is there evidence that there's a desert that may be forming in the Amazon basin due to all the deforestation down there?
Yes, it's quite possible. A number of ecologists have warned us of this, that this very lush Amazon desert, if we're not careful, could become another Sahara Desert. And that would have devastating effects, not only for the Brazilian economy, but for the world at large. Because that's the place where you got the greatest diversity of species. So that could all be eliminated simply by cutting down the jungle trees. So That could also happen to Africa. You know, we have a very big wet jungle in what is now the Congo region, and that also could easily be transformed into a desert. So, yeah, I'm not implying that we only got two problems to worry about, the Gobi and the Sahara.
I brought that up, that there has been so much rampant deforestation. It's just greater than any place else I'm aware of as far as the large area in the last 30 years or so.
Well, it could happen here in North America, too. If we were to start cutting down, say, the Canadian forests in the north, that's a place that only gets 10 inches of rain right now. Forests thrive there because of the fact that so little of the water evaporates. So 10 inches of rain is adequate to support millions of square miles of forest in northern Canada. But if you start cutting those trees down at a rapid rate, that's going to lower the rainfall amount, and now you could turn that whole thing into tundra rather than taiga. We could do the same thing to Siberia. So these are issues. But there's also another thing where it could go the other way around. What if you were to shut down the Gulf Stream in the Atlantic? That could have the impact of dropping a lot more water on Siberia and northern Canada as rainfall. Well, it's cold there. And what's going to happen is it's going to be snowing, not raining. That snow is going to build up, and you got the return of the Ice Age. So the way the ocean currents are running right now, it's holding the Ice Age at bay. But as an astronomer, I can tell you we're now entering a phase of the orbit of the Earth around the Sun where we're getting more greater eccentricity, which means in wintertime and summertime we're more distant or nearer than the Sun than we otherwise would be. Actually, this is another part of the equation. Right now, we're at a point in the orbit of the Earth where we are closest to the Sun in what is the Northern Hemisphere's wintertime, and the other way around for summer. Now, notice when you look at the continental landmass, it doesn't really show up in this one. Maybe this would be a better slide to show you. That when you look at the Southern Hemisphere, it's almost entirely oceans, not much continents. And if you look at the Northern Hemisphere, it's essentially all land masses, not much water. Now, that works great if you're in that point of the Earth's orbit where you're closest to the Sun in the northern winter, because that's going to make the winters in the north warmer and the summers cooler. And if you're in the south, there isn't a lot of land mass there anyway. And the land mass you do have in the south, let me bring it back to this slide. Notice that South America is shaped like a triangle. And the same thing's true of Africa. Most of the mass of the southern hemisphere is near the equator, not down. Now, when you're near the equator, it doesn't really matter whether you're closer to the sun in summer or winter. But it really does matter if you're at, say, 40 or 50 or 60 degrees latitude. Well, at 40, 50, 60 degrees latitude, all you got is a tiny bit of land mass in southern Chile and Argentina. And if you go over to Africa, there's really nothing because Africa stops at about 32 degrees south latitude. And likewise, Australia is fairly close to the equator. All you got to worry about is Antarctica. Well, not very many people live in Antarctica anyway, so nothing much to worry about. But if you look at the northern hemisphere, you've got Asia and North America, and you notice that North America is shaped like the other opposite triangle, which puts most of the land mass of North America at high latitudes. Well, what does that mean? We're living at the best time in terms of the orbit of the Earth about the Sun. You say, well, how much time we're talking about? That orbital cycle is 100,000 years. So there's about a 15,000-year wide window when you're at the optimal moment where you're closest to the sun in the wintertime if you're living in the northern hemisphere. 50,000 years from now, it's going to be the other way around. And when that happens, it's going to be much colder wintertime in the northern hemisphere than it is now and much hotter in the summertime. And that, again, helps drive the Ice Age. In fact, if you look at the change in the variation of Earth's eccentricity, which is basically the elliptical shape of our orbit, it's a 100,000-year cycle of variation. And that's identical to the Ice Age cycle. The typical ice age cycle for the past 7 million years, you get 90,000 years of ice interspersed with 10,000 years of what we call a warm interglacial. And you say, well, we've been doing better than that. We've gone 15,000 years before we've had the end of the last ice age. Well, that's thanks to human activity. Because of human activity, we pushed the interglacial from 10,000 years to 15,000 years. But there's a limit to how much longer we can push it. An ice age is indeed coming as the Earth's orbit begins to cause a greater eccentricity than what we've had in the past. And so there will come a time when it's going to be closest to the sun in the summertime and most distant in the wintertime. But right now, we're in the optimal window. Now, what does this tell us? If you look at those solar neutrinos, it tells us there's a 100,000-year-wide window when conditions are best for human beings. But if you look at the orbit of the Earth and the shape of our continents and where the continents are oriented, that window shrinks down to about 10,000 years when things are really optimal for human beings, maybe 15,000 years if you carefully manage the heating of the planet by making sure you got lots of cows and you got lots of automobiles throwing out exhaust of carbon dioxide. Or you're cutting down forests. And of course, people are arguing we're overdoing it now. We got too many cows, too many automobiles, and too much forest land being cut down. There is a question over here.
Now, is the eccentricity involved with a precession of the eccentricity rather than a magnitude? In other words, the eccentricity isn't actually increasing, but it's just simply shifting?
Okay, there's actually three effects. I simplified things. There's three things that affect the climate of the Earth with respect to Earth's orbit. One is the changing shape of the elliptical nature of Earth's orbit about the sun, what we astronomers call the eccentricity. So the eccentricity varies with a 100,000-year cycle right now. Actually, it's more complex than that. There are three things causing a change in the eccentricity, but right now it's a 100,000-year cycle. In addition to that, the tilt of the Earth's orbit relative to the solar system plane, that varies over a 41,000-year cycle. And that also has an impact on our climate. In fact, if you go back about 20 million years, that had a bigger impact on our climate than the eccentricity variation, which meant that the ice age had a cycle of 40,000 years instead of 100,000 years like it does today. And then the third factor is the one that you mentioned, which is the precession of the rotation axis of the Earth. Let me try to simplify that for you. I've got a diagram. It'll take me too long to pull it up. Earth is rotating fairly rapidly, and it's kind of like one of these children's toys. You remember these little toys you get where you have a spinning top and you kind of push the handle down like that, get the thing spinning, and then you kind of throw it out on the floor? Well, you notice it rotates very rapidly, but while it's rotating very rapidly, it precesses. And you'll see the axis of the spinning top go through a variation like that. Same thing happens with the Earth. And so our precession cycle is about 26,000 years. And that also has an impact on the climate. But the biggest impact today comes from the eccentricity variation. The second biggest impact is the inclination. The least significant one is the precession of Earth's orbit.
But an increase in eccentricity would actually moderate the climate because that would mean it would be further in the summer and even closer in the winter. That's what I'm not understanding. If it's an increase in eccentricity, that would have a beneficial effect.
Well, an increase in eccentricity is going to cause climatic extremes all over the planet. So North and South America would both be affected by an increase in eccentricity.
So as we get closer in the winter and further away in the summer, that increases the climatic extremes?
Well, it does in this... Okay, again, you're making me get into more complexities than I really want to do. Because there's actually several factors that work into how benign a climate you have. It's partial, but again, there are multiple contributions based on Earth's orbit about the sun that affect the climate. The bottom line right now is you get a 100,000-year cycle. And the bottom line is that means we have optimal conditions if you're a northern hemisphere dweller today. And it lasts, you know, for about 10, 15,000 years. But my second point is that because of the orientation of the continents, and it's not just the orientation, I'm showing you this slide on purpose, in the sense that this is a map of what the geography of the ocean floor looks like. And so this is just looking at the Indian Ocean, where you can see that there's shallow parts and there are deep parts, and there's ridges. There's actually mountain ranges that you see in the, this for example is an undersea mountain range right here. You get another one right here, some islands pop up. And I think most of you are aware of what's called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is a long range of mountains that literally goes from the Arctic all the way down to Antarctica, that basically is right down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And what's actually happening is the Atlantic Ocean's getting bigger, the Pacific Ocean's getting smaller as a result of plate tectonic activity, but it also causes the buildup of these mountain ranges, but it also structures the flow of ocean currents, and it works in such a way as to give maximum oxygen content in the ocean. And what does that do? It maximizes the fish stocks in the ocean. Now, the oceans always have life. It's not that the biomass of the ocean changes as a result of this, but what happens is the kind of life will change. And so we've got low oxygen in the oceans. That means you're not going to have a lot of fish. The fish aren't going to have enough oxygen to breathe, so they're either all going to be at the surface, or in some cases they might not even thrive at the surface. And instead you're going to get a whole lot of life growing at the bottom of the ocean floor that doesn't need oxygen. But that's bad news for the rest of us. If you get a lot of this bottom-dwelling life on the ocean that doesn't need oxygen, guess what it's expelling into the atmosphere? It doesn't expel carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It expels hydrogen sulfide into the atmosphere. Hydrogen sulfide is what we call rotten egg gas. And our noses are very sensitive to this rotten egg gas because it's a deadly poison. Even a tiny amount in this room, for example, is enough that all of us will begin to smell it. And we don't have a very good sense of smell. But I think God purposely gave us a very sensitive smell to hydrogen sulfide because it is such a deadly poison. But a number of scientists have made the point, we are now living in an incredibly optimal moment when hydrogen sulfide in the atmosphere is at an extreme minimum. And because it's at an extreme minimum, we can have large-bodied mammals running around the continental land masses, and we can have large-bodied mammals in the oceans, dolphins and whales. All that's possible because the oceans are oxygen-rich and hydrogen sulfide-poor. But this is something that is quite temporal. And you know, research is now showing that there are numerous events in the history of the Earth where it goes from hydrogen sulfide rich to oxygen poor, then the other way around. Right now, we're living at a time when the oceans have the most oxygen and the least amount of hydrogen sulfide, although there have been scientists warning us that we humans are beginning to upset the balance. And probably where we see that in greatest evidence is Chesapeake Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. And what's happening there is that industrial runoff from the rivers of the eastern United States are beginning to put chemicals into the Potomac River and Chesapeake Bay and the Gulf of Mexico that are making those regions oxygen poor, and they've seen the fish stocks just drop catastrophically in those regions. Yes?
So the last ice age was 15,000 years ago.
Well, the last ice age lasted from, say, 100,000 years ago to about 10 to 15,000 years ago. It's a little bit difficult. I've gotten in trouble with this by referring to the end of the last ice age, because what do you mean by the end of the last ice age? I grew up in Canada. We're still seeing the end of the last ice age in Canada because the great glaciers that proliferate over the mountains of British Columbia are still melting, and those glaciers formed during the last ice age. And so you might say the ice age hasn't ended yet because we still have glaciers in Alaska and in British Columbia. But for example, 15,000 years ago, there were glaciers in what is now Arabia. But they've completely melted. And so the
many were brought up in the ice age. All of man that went all over the place was brought up in the ice age.
Yeah, when God created Adam and Eve, the ice age was still in effect. Although the ice age was beginning to recede. So even 40,000 years ago, the ice age was far from its peak. So the snow and ice was already in a process of melting at that time.
That's why maybe they migrated more south? Or?
Well, right, and that's why you have to wait until about 15,000 years ago before it becomes possible for humans to populate Siberia and then migrate from Siberia into Alaska and down to North and South America, because you literally got to wait for the ice to recede enough where that becomes a possible migration pathway. But with Adam and Eve being created in what is probably now the Persian Gulf, it would have been very a benign climate at that time, not as hot as it is now, and it would have been plenty of water because of the flow of ice and snow melt off of Arabia and off of what is now Iran would have been flowing into that region. So it also explains how you get the four rivers coming together in Genesis 2. Two of those four rivers today don't flow. Only two flow today because there's still ice in Turkey that's feeding the Tigris and the Euphrates.
I'm sorry, no more questions. We didn't
I'm actually out of time. So anyway, the ice age, and then we're going to talk about atmospheric oxygen. We're living at the ideal oxygen moment, not too much, not too little. By the way, having too much oxygen in our atmosphere is a bad thing. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time looking at how we're living at an ideal time in history where we've got the optimal amounts of petroleum, natural gas, coal, and a new fossil fuel that people really haven't paid much attention to called clathrates. Say, what are clathrates? It's basically methane hydrate. What's methane hydrate? It's ice that burns. Kind of an interesting thing. You can actually get a chunk of clathrate. It looks just like ice, but you can light a match to it and it burns. Because what is it? It's a crystalline form of water and methane. But we now know, let me see if I can pull this up here for you. This is where all the clathrates exist. What's going on? Yeah, here we go. Whoops. Let me pull that up here again for you. The clathrates literally exceed the total quantity of fossil fuels on planet Earth today, both recoverable and non-recoverable, including the shale and the tar sands, and very low-quality coal, exceed it by about 2,000 to 500,000 times. So that's how much natural gas is bottled up in these clathrates. But we're living in a brief moment of time when that is at a maximum level. We'll cover that next week. Father in heaven, Father, we're just blown away by what has been discovered in these last few years that reveals how you really did choose the very best possible time to put Adam and Eve here on planet Earth, and the very best possible time for us human beings to launch and sustain global high technology civilization. Lord, I pray that you would really give us a grateful heart for all that you've done to make possible the incredible standard of living we all get to enjoy. But Father in heaven, I pray that we would take advantage of all the resources that you've given us, the optimization that you put in place for us, that we would use it for our best purposes, the best purposes of all the life that you've had share this planet with us, but most significantly, Lord, that we would use it to fulfill your purpose for us here on planet Earth, that we would be able to fulfill the Great Commission of bringing the good news to every ethnic group here on planet Earth and usher in the replacement of this universe by the new creation and the new physics that we'll be able to enjoy there. In Jesus' name, amen.
Can I make an announcement?